This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Buy on the rumor, sell on the news. A Wall Street adage, if ever there was one. But today, nobody was buying on the rumor that the federal government was about to nationalize a bunch of the country's big banks. The rumors come around before, and it's always the same result. Everybody sells. So much for that adage. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the 20th day of February. As we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis, we turn yet again to the banks. Despite billions of dollars in government bailout money, some of the nation's biggest banking institutions find themselves on the verge of penny stock status. Early today, rumors ricocheted around Wall Street, again, that the likes of Citigroup and Bank of America might be nationalized, taken over by the federal government. Bank stocks quickly took down the entire market before White House spokesman Robert Gibbs moved to reassure investors.
This administration continues to strongly believe that a privately held banking system is the correct way to go, ensuring that they are regulated sufficiently by this government.
But if the White House message was aimed at calming Wall Street's worries, Marketplace's Bob Moon tells us it was only marginally effective.
Citigroup stock hemorrhaged for the sixth straight day, losing close to a quarter of its meager remaining value and slipping below $2 a share. Josh Rosner is managing director at Graham Fisher. He's not optimistic the government can avoid nationalization and keep the banks private.
Government needs to do something, but we're not really seeing them do something, and we're not sure when they will actually get around to it.
Rosner says until investors are sure nationalization is off the table, they're likely to keep avoiding risky financial stocks. And that is only adding to the woes of Citigroup and Bank of America. But at Farr, Miller & Washington, Chief Investment Officer Michael Farr explains why investors aren't tempted by these rock-bottom prices. Nationalization, if it happens, would leave nothing for shareholders.
If markets return to normal, these levels will look remarkably cheap. If not, then you're going to say, gee, that was a waste of money. My advice is always, if you're going to speculate and gamble, go to Vegas, because even when you lose your money there, they give you a free drink.
Jeffrey Hart is market research chief at Sandler O'Neill. He argues the stock price doesn't really matter. As he sees it, the government's already done enough to make a full takeover, even if Citigroup, less likely.
Even if their stock price is down at $2, really all their liabilities at this point have been guaranteed by the federal government. As long as people have confidence the U.S. government can make good on its debts, they should be confident in both B of A and Citigroup.
Hart even says those stocks could be a good buy for investors able to stomach the risk. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Banks, of course, are but one facet of this crisis and recovery attempt. Earlier this week, President Barack Obama unveiled a new foreclosure prevention plan to generally positive reviews from economists, but never mind them. Even though the plan could help as many as 9 million homeowners, some of the other millions have little something to say about that. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
Yesterday, CNBC's Rick Santelli was at the Chicago Board of Trade. He started complaining that Obama's plan rewards people who took out mortgages they knew they couldn't afford. Then he turned to the traders.
How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all?
Santelli seems to have touched a populist nerve.
those of us who did buy within our budget and bought something we could afford were the ones who are getting screwed now.
Mayor Runge is upset that she can't sell or refinance her Chicago home. She doesn't qualify for government help. Neither does Margot Miller of suburban Detroit. She wants her loan downsized.
Lower the principal for everybody and make everybody even.
There are no polls yet on Obama's plan, but in December, the Pew Research Center asked if the government should help homeowners facing foreclosure. Pew pollster Michael Dimmick says 49% of the respondents said yes, 43% no.
They don't like bailing people out of problems they dug for themselves, and I think that's where you're finding the mixed reaction to this.
Dimmick says there's no shortage of opinions because this issue hits very close to home. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So what is it about this particular issue that's got folks so mad that they just don't want to take it anymore? Or give it, I suppose, when we're talking about foreclosure rescue money. Americans have a general history of propping one another up when we're down. What's so different about this time? And what's that they say about glass houses? With us to sort things out is Randy Cohen, ethics columnist for the New York Times Magazine. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's start with a little definition. How do you define ethical behavior?
Ethics concerns are the effects of our actions on other people. And so ethical behavior is that which has a benign effect on other people or certainly doesn't do harm to other people.
Given that definition, you know, as we've just heard from Nancy, there is a lot of, shall we say, frustration out there from people who say, look, I did nothing wrong. I was responsible. My neighbor's going to get a bailout. Where's mine? Even though I don't really need it. How are we supposed to reconcile, I guess, kind of the greater good versus individual fairness, especially when it comes to the dollars in our pockets?
It's an understandable feeling, but it's a poor guide to public policy. Once you start conjuring up this Victorian notion of the undeserving poor. Look, we help people who make mistakes all the time. When someone goes to the emergency room, the doctors don't question their moral worth. They make a medical decision. We send the fire department to someone's house without asking, why did their house catch fire? What it is to live in a community is to shoulder the burden of responding to the needs of those around you without making moral judgments.
But, you know, there seems to be this notion that helping people in trouble is equivalent to rewarding them for bad behavior. But as you said, we choose as a society to help people all the time. Why is this different?
Here's why. To make a bad financial decision isn't a moral failing. It's a practical failing. It's a financial failing. There were people who made moral failings who should be scrutinized. A banker who has a sworn duty to issue prudent mortgages and who is negligent about how much down payment should I demand, what's a reasonable monthly payment for someone with this income. That person has morally transgressed. A person who takes a mortgage on his or her home and gets in over their head has not morally transgressed.
I feel like some of this is similar in many ways to the anger that you saw during the debate over the bank bailout a few months ago. Then it was, you know, corporate America versus the population. But at a certain point, people became very resigned to the idea that, okay, we're going to have to do this. Now it's almost household versus household. How, if at all, does that change the ethical debate?
Significantly. The banker we were just talking about has a genuine professional duty to issue prudent mortgages. The federal regulators who are overseeing the financial sector have a sworn duty to make sure prudent practices are observed. If those people deliberately abrogate those responsibilities, they've committed moral failings and we're rightly angry at them and should tax them for that. If an individual makes a foolish financial decision, that's ignorance. They acted unwisely, but not unethically. And, you know, in my view, you're not going to succeed in social policy that takes people out and flogs them for this. We tried that. It was called debtor's prison. We saw being poor as a moral failing and responded punitively. Didn't work out so well. We've had much better luck with prudent banking laws. That kind of regulation seems a much more practical response to how human beings behave.
So for those who are feeling more than a little angry about all this, you're suggesting maybe just chill out?
Yeah, that's a very natural feeling, and I feel it too. If I've played by the rules, if I've led a frugal life, it's hard not to resent the people who have done so and are now being helped at my expense in part. we should recognize that those feelings are also not that which is best about us. We should look to the better angels of our nature.
And I guess you have to wonder what a world would look like where we all got what we deserved.
A terrible thing. A horrifying thing. We'd all be in hell if we got what we deserved.
Randy Cohen writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
I enjoyed talking to you.
On Wall Street, there is just nothing good to say about the end of a miserable week. The Dow lost another 100 points, once again on its way to breaking below the 7,000 mark. We'll have all the details when we do the numbers. The price of an ounce of gold closed at $1,001.80 today. Investors fled to the shiny metal as they watched bank stocks plummet. Gold is seen as a so-called safe haven, a place to park your money where you know it'll always be worth something. If the $1,000 per ounce news finds you fingering your gold ring or serpentine necklace right now, well, join the party. No, really, join the gold party. Ronnie Bradbill has our story.
There are more than two dozen guests at this Virginia home just outside Washington, D.C. They're here for a gold party. It's somewhat like a Tupperware party, but instead of buying plastic, guests are selling gold. Tangled clumps of unwanted, outdated, or broken necklaces, bracelets, and earrings. Anything they can dig up for cash.
You actually go to this party and you make money. That's a big deal.
Ileana Parati made $500 at another gold party and came to this one to sell a little more. It works like this. The host invites friends and a buyer. In this case, local jeweler J.J. Singh, who buys gold for Atlanta-based company Golden Girls. She sits down with each guest and, with high-tech equipment, determines if the pieces are in fact gold.
So that's lighting up at 14 karat, and now it just popped to 18. Is this an Italian piece?
The gold is weighed, and the guest is handed a check based on the day's market rate.
$250, I can take my husband out for a great dinner or something. Or I can go buy a new piece of jewelry. That's even better.
This was Terry Taylor's first gold party. She came with an old tie clip and a serpentine chain, a gift from her ex. In some cases, guests run home and pick up more loot, like Catherine Drahozel, who needs a new roof for her home and wanted the cash more than the memories.
My first boyfriend, I got rid of one of the chains he gave me, and I've kept that all these years, and it's gone.
Most of what the guests bring is jewelry, but J.J. Singh says there are surprises.
When the first few gold teeth came in, it was a little disconcerting. One gold tooth did come in with the actual tooth enamel part still attached.
Once the gold is collected, whatever it might be, Singh mails the metal to a refinery where it's melted and recycled. If all goes well, the refinery pays her a higher price than she paid out to the guests. The party host gets a cut, and Golden Girls donates 2.5% to a charity of the host's choice. With gold prices so high, Singh says it's tough to keep up with seller demand, and that might be the case for a while. Frank Holmes, CEO of U.S. Global Investors, says gold will become increasingly valuable as the Fed prints more money to pump into the economy.
Money supply is growing more rapidly than the amount of gold that's coming out. Gold has a high correlation to money supply. Historically, that money supply turns around and starts buying gold, and gold prices start to rise.
And if that happens, gold parties could continue to gain popularity.
So your total is $174.44.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to say goodbye.
I'm going to say goodbye.
See you later. Give me the check.
In Washington, I'm Ronnie Radbill for Marketplace.
It was a big week, folks. A lot of long-awaited things happened. The president signed the economic recovery bill, also announced a new mortgage relief plan. The latest alleged Ponzi schemer, Alan Stanford, was caught. Oh, and the stock market continued to slide. Joining us for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond is Andy Brooks, chief trader for T. Rowe Price. Hi, Andy.
Hi there.
And Heidi Moore, who is the lead writer for the Wall Street Journal's Deal Journal. Hello again, Heidi.
Hi there.
So, Andy, let me start with you. How you doing?
Well, I guess I've been better. It's been a rough week. It's been a rough start to the year. And boy, this market is challenging. And it's challenging even the most positive among us.
Yeah, you know, we had all these economic relief plans out of Washington, D.C. What do investors want?
Well, I think that's probably a big part of the problem. They don't know what they want. They want relief. They want certainty. They want to see light at the end of the tunnel. And obviously, it's an incredibly complicated process, and the economy is complicated, and the answers are not easy to find. What I think is somewhat challenging for us is people just aren't willing to give the economy or Mr. Geithner or Mr. Obama the benefit of the doubt. And we've got to sort of get on board here. The crisis in confidence continues, and until we get comfortable knowing that we're going to work through this, it's a challenging time for investors.
Heidi, what do you think is going on here?
Well, I think, you know, it's very interesting the point that you make about how investors sort of need to give Geithner and Bernanke and Obama a little bit of time. I think they also need to distinguish themselves in showing that they have some sort of coherent plan in place. I mean, the problems of the last administration when it came to this economic stimulus was that everything was done in a very fly-by-night fashion, you know, designed to, you know, control against the movements of the markets. You had a lot of weekend restructurings and weekend sales. And it just all felt very uncertain and very sloppy. And that has continued even into this year under a new administration. And that just freaks people out.
And I wonder if there's more than a little bit of impatience going on here. I mean, we're a month away from the year anniversary of Bear Stearns. It's been 6-7 months since Lehman Brothers, and we're no better off than we were.
That's exactly right. And really the core problem here is the core problem that has always been the case, going back to 2007, well before Bear Stearns. It was always these toxic assets, these mortgage securities that are falling in value every day. And until you get those assets off the books of the banks, you're really just, it might as well be 2007. Time hasn't passed.
Andy, there's got to be something good we can look at here. Can you help us out?
Well, here's something that's perhaps good. Roche, the global pharmaceutical company, did the biggest bond deal in the U.S., I think, ever. They raised $16 billion. And that should suggest that parts of the market are functioning. Things are happening. People are investing. People are thinking about asset classes and how to deploy monies into the markets. That, I hope, will have a positive impact at some point on the stock market. And I think Heidi's right. We absolutely need to come up with some way to dispose of these toxic assets. The banks have got to see a way out. Consumers have to see a way out. And investors have got to know that there's something in place that's going to start working. But it could be that the early signs of the fixed income market really starting to work pretty well might provide that opportunity.
How about you, Heidi? Any optimism?
To start with Andy's point, I think he's absolutely right about the Roche bond sale. Pfizer was also able to raise $22.5 billion to buy Wyeth and another pharmaceutical deal. So there is a sign that the corporate credit markets are opening, and that's at least one part of the credit crunch that has eased up in the short term. There was a big IPO last week, so we have that as well. And then it just comes to perception, right? We always have this problem of perception. So a lot of the banks have learned to deal with gossip when it happens, to absolutely be all over it instead of standing back like a Bear Stearns or a Lehman Brothers, for instance, Ken Lewis today, talking about nationalization and talking to his employees, trying to comfort them, trying to pull the troops together and saying, this is not going to happen and you need to know that. Whereas maybe in previous months, they just may have let that gossip go on.
All right. Always good to wrap up the week on a note of comfort. Andy Brooks and Heidi Moore, thanks so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Coming up, British filmmakers dance into America's movie theaters.
My experience of people in the entertainment industry in the States is that they will give you the time. They want to see if you've got something that could possibly be the next big thing.
But first, let's do the numbers. It could have been worse, but thanks to those reassuring words from the White House we mentioned earlier, the stock market was able to recover a bit from a dismal start. The Dow lost 100 points, 1.3%, to close at 73.65. The Nasdaq managed to hold its decline to a single point, 0.1%, to finish at 14.41. The S&P shaved off 8 points, 1.1%, wrapping up at 770. It was a trying week overall, though. The Dow dropped 6.2% just since Monday. The NASDAQ tumbled 6.1%. The broader S&P fell 6.9%. We told you earlier about the topsy-turvy day for financial stocks. At one point, B of A was down 36%, but they finished down 3.5%. Citigroup shares haven't been this cheap since 1991. You can buy a share for $1.95. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee discusses health care reform. President Obama is planning for a fiscal responsibility summit to take place at the White House with lawmakers, economists, and others. And on February 23rd, 1945, U.S. Marines raised the American flag on the Pacific island of Iwo Jima. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Beijing today and through the weekend. She's talking with Chinese leaders about how to ride out this global recession. But she also wants to tackle climate change. China and the U.S. are the world's biggest sources of carbon emissions. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Together, China and the U.S. exhale 40% of the world's carbon. Secretary Clinton thinks the two can collaborate to reduce that footprint. And Saturday in Beijing, she tours a clean-burning natural gas power plant. It's run jointly by General Electric and a Chinese company. James McGregor is an author and consultant in Beijing.
The leadership of Beijing, their children and grandchildren are breathing the same polluted air that I breathe every day. So I think there's going to be some nice talk that comes out of the secretary's visit.
And that talk may turn into action in December. That's when Copenhagen hosts a global climate summit. And the big question is whether China and the U.S. agree to cap carbon emissions. For now, industrial China relies largely on fossil fuels. In fact, Beijing this week committed $35 billion to lock in crude oil supplies from Brazil and Russia.
Prices are down. China's got money. If I was in their seat, I'd be doing the same thing.
China is also buying up U.S. bonds. Right now, it holds about $700 billion worth. And Chinese leaders are looking to Secretary Clinton for explicit assurances those bonds are secure. Pan Rei teaches at Fudan University in Shanghai.
If the U.S. dollar weakens or depreciates, our investments will have lost value. If that happens, we'll be less motivated to buy more.
China's not the only buyer on the market, but it's an important one. Last fall, it leapfrogged Japan to become the largest foreign holder of U.S. government debt. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The British-made movie Slumdog Millionaire stands a good chance of winning something at the Oscars on Sunday. It has 10 nominations, including Best Picture. The film is one of those British sleeper hits. Think The Full Monty. Ignored at first in Britain, but exploding on the international scene after getting a U.S. distributor. Scores of independent filmmakers in Britain hope their movies will follow suit. One example, a film about Morris dancing. What? You've never heard of Morris dancing? An ancient British folk tradition where guys in white shirts wave hankies and bash sticks together? Well, Marketplace's Stephen Beard advises us to get ready for the hot new thing.
We all set, nice and smart, two straight lines.
This may not seem the most promising theme for a full-length movie.
Give it plenty right this time!
Morris dancing is an offbeat, ancient pastime performed here by the Datchet border team, These days, the dancers can often be seen in the summer capering outside country pubs with their curious paraphernalia.
We've got the bell pads on our shins. We've got the sticks in our hands. And then we've got handkerchiefs as well, which we always use in the dancing.
This 500-year-old English eccentricity has now been parlayed into a comic feature film.
Morris dancing. Seemingly an innocent pub pastime involving hanky-waving bearded men.
Morris, A Life with Bells On, tells the story of one man's struggle to modernise the dance. Poking gentle fun, it's proving quite a hit with English audiences.
I could recognise the caricatures of certain types of people, and I really enjoyed it.
I laughed like a drain. I thought it was wonderful, I really did.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, very tongue-in-cheek.
But the audiences have been tiny. Only a few hundred people have seen the movie at special screenings in village halls. There hasn't been a general release. Writer Chas Oldham says the distributors didn't share his enthusiasm for the subject.
They think it's too niche and they're not sure that there's a market for it here, and therefore they're not prepared to take that risk.
And risk there certainly is. The distributor buys the rights, pays for the prints and markets the movie. That can run into millions. The director, Lucy Ackhurst, hopes to persuade a more entrepreneurial American distributor to pick up her film.
My experience of people in the entertainment industry in the States is that they will give you the time. They want to see if you've got something that could possibly be the next big thing.
After all, she says, look at the Full Monty, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and other British movies that were hits in the US first before they even opened in the UK. But Terry Eilert of the Film Business Academy says these were exceptions. Don't be surprised if Morris doesn't sweep American distributors off their feet.
I mean, American distributors make exactly the same calculations as everybody else, and if it's a British film, they'd want to know why it hadn't been distributed in its home market.
But on the positive side, he says, an odd subject matter is no bar to success.
Slumdog Millionaire, what could be less likely? A combination of Mumbai slum life and a TV game show. I mean, what could be less likely as a subject? I don't think subjects matter in films, really.
Unlikely as it seems, the producers of Morris hope their curious little movie will strike some chords and ring a few bells in America. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And we have a link to the Morris A Life with Bells On trailer on our website. Go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, the Associated Press has been looking into those debit cards that some states use to provide unemployment benefits. Turns out that laid-off workers are getting a twofer. They're not just losing their jobs, they're paying fees to access their unemployment money. There are overdraft fees as well as per-withdrawal fees, even though in some states you have no option but to use the card. AP says all 30 states that use bank debit cards for unemployment subject users to fees. The states themselves don't pay anything. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 100 points, 1.3%. The Nasdaq lost a point, or 0.1%. The S&P lost 8 points, 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Next time on the program, forget homes and precious jewels as collateral. One Italian bank takes Kurds in whey.
If the producers cannot pay back the loan, we simply sell their cheese we have in storage to recoup our losses.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that on Monday.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks.
Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.